areas of the city where it would be legal and safe to sleep.
Safe sleeping zones within 40% of the city, yes. Non-residential, non-beach areas.
Well, what about, again, this Jillian Creamsites idea, and actually it was an idea shared by a lot of liberals in the early 90s who were part of the Coalition for a Safe Place to Sleep. Eventually resulted in, you know, permitting for a brief period of time the Coral Street Open Air Shelter, where homeless people actually did sleep in 94 and 95. You say that you don't want, you know, to make it legal for people to sleep in the streets. You want to make it legal for people to sleep somewhere where it's safe and sensible.
We're not making it legal for people to sleep in the streets with this initiative, first of all. Secondly, I think her suggestion is best directed towards the city council that has the power right now in Section 2 of the capping ordinance to do something about it. Our initiative is a human rights initiative. It is not a social service initiative. We do not stand up to social service criticism. That's true, because we're not providing any social services with this initiative. We think first we have to gain the human right to sleep, because that is, it's not only an attack on homeless people and an attack on poor people. It's not only the front line of the war of the poor in Santa Cruz. It is also a wound in the heart of Santa Cruz and a problem in the mind of the police department that we have to shift.
Now, you know, it's interesting that this problem has been viewed as a human rights violation, as a violation of the Constitution, but today, on Easter Sunday, you were bringing this issue to the public from a different perspective by taking it to the churches.
Well, we did that last Sunday. We're doing it again to some extent this Sunday, and we're doing it big time next Sunday. When it comes to human rights issues, it's always been tradition in this country that it's been the churches, social workers, activists that have to make the change. Laws don't get made by politicians who are beholden to department heads and to take away powers away from them. To take power away from the police department, this basically gives them license to do whatever they want to, this law. And so to take that power away usually does take the power of the religious, takes the power of people in the streets, takes the power of people passing around petitions. And of course, one of the safest places for human rights activists to go for help is to the churches.
So what are you going to be doing today, and what do you anticipate is going to
I'm going to be doing a lot today. As a matter of fact, I got to get off the line right now. I mean, I got to go finish making my ambrosia for the HIV potluck, and then also I'm going to be at the Catholic Church, at Holy Cross Church, most of the day today. We have people going to be at the Progressive Baptist Church, and people going to be at the Episcopalian Calvary Church.
If folks want to help, is there a number they can call?
Yes, there is. You know what that number is?
It's 429-5284, I would guess. And that's David Silva giving us an update on the sleeping ban repeal initiative campaign. He's actually out at the church now as our other workers passing out literature, seeking petition signatures, trying to involve the religious community in what is a fundamental religious issue of human rights, the right of people to sleep at night. And in the studio with us, arriving from an area where I guess it's still legal to sleep at night in Nicaragua, is Dorothy Granada. Hi, Dorothy.
Hi, Robert. It's very nice to be with you. I'm delighted to see that you're still in the struggle for dignity and championing for the human rights of human beings here in Santa Cruz. It's very nice to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, listen, I'm struggling in my own middle-class, laid-back way. I'm not dodging bullets like you were doing in the 80s in the midst of the Contra War in Nicaragua. And I see at least the Sentinel is giving you a little attention on the front page, talking about what you're up to down there. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that. Although, frankly, my interest is in what you were doing here in Santa Cruz before you left, which is, along with other activists like Charles Gray, fighting for human rights here on our home turf in Santa Cruz.
Well, I believe, Robert, I think like you and many others, that if we're going to realize our humanity, we have to first look at the people that live around us. I, as a Christian, as a church person, I have to look at who are the people who are outside the doors of the church, who don't have places to sleep. What is my relationship to them? So, of course, I was very involved in the peace and justice struggle, the nonviolent struggle for dignity here in Santa Cruz. And that had carried me, my concern for what's happening here, carried me to Nicaragua during the revolutionary government.
Well, maybe you can talk a little bit about talk a little bit about that. I'm going to keep drawing you back to Santa Cruz, although I know you haven't been here for a while. It's been, what, a decade?
Well, I come here every year. We have a very strong support community here within the peace community, and I come back every year to check in. We nourish each other in the struggle here and there, and I still consider Santa Cruz my home, even though I haven't physically lived here for a number of years.
It's interesting. It's kind of ironic that the same folks who support you so fervently in Nicaragua, many of those same folks oppose human rights here in Santa Cruz in terms of changing the sleeping ban law. Any thoughts on that?
I think we all have our fears, Robert. And I think the fear of losing our homes is a big fear. And I think that if we speak to our friends who care about what's happening in other parts of the world, if we speak to them about the fact and educate them, and this is what part of my job is here to do, is to help people in this country to understand that what is killing people in Nicaragua, the military-industrial capitalist complex, which is killing people in Nicaragua and in two-thirds of the world, is also putting people on the streets in this country. And so many people, Robert, are one paycheck away from losing their homes and being on the streets themselves. Well, this is a fearful thing. And I never had the courage, though I lived very simply and shared a room with my partner and learned how to find food and clothing out of dumpsters, and I hitchhiked if I wanted to go someplace, I had that little room that I could always go back to. I was never courageous enough to leave that little room. Well, shelter is, yes, it is a fundamental human right, but I do understand the fear that people have. And one of my jobs as being sent from the peace movement, the peace and justice movement in this country, to Nicaragua to accompany the people in Nicaragua in their struggle, is to show people in this country the connections and to help us understand that if we say brother, sister to people in Nicaragua, we must be able to say brother, sister and act on that to people in this country who are even closer.
So how long have you been back now,
Dorothy? We've been back in the country for 2 weeks, and we've got three more weeks. And then we're returning to Nicaragua. I'm traveling with a coworker, a Nicaraguan woman, who is an organizer of women. She's one of the most militant feminists in the country. And we are reporting back to groups that have supported us. We hope they will continue to support us. And we're also trying to keep in the consciousness of people in this country Nicaragua and what's happening, and also to make the connections. Runaway shops, the racism and classism, which is forcing more and more people to be isolated, homeless, marginalized, killing people. You know, they're killing someone at San Quentin this week. It's unbelievable, this country. You know, the Sandinistas, the first thing they did July 19, 1979, was to abolish the death penalty. I mean, it's just unreal, some of the barbarous things that are happening in this country. But more and more, we have to see the connections. We have to see that we're in one lifeboat on this planet. And yes, I do speak. I try to bring the truth of the empire home to people who are living comfortably here in this country, not to make them uncomfortable, but to invite people to share responsibility for what's happening in this world. On the streets here in Santa Cruz, San Francisco, and also what is happening to people who are losing their lives in Nicaragua. Yes, you have the right to put up a little shack out of bits of wood, bamboo, mud, if you can find a little piece of land in Nicaragua.
Unlike in Santa Cruz.
Unlike in Santa Cruz, yes. In many ways, it is more human. It is more human in Nicaragua. If a campesino is homeless, I have seen a campesino in one day build a shelter for his family, only having a machete. And nobody would dream of knocking it down until, of course, the some rich landowner decides that that land is his or he wants that landowner, then he will drive the campesino off. I mean, that is the struggle. You know, I am not, it is not a paradise there. There is structural repression of the poor, structural repression coming from the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. That is what is killing Nicaragua and the rest of the two-thirds of the world, really. You know, we talk about the third world, and really we should say two-thirds of the world, because that's the condition. Now, Nicaragua is the one of the poorest. It's the second now poorest country in Latin America after Haiti. And it is poor specifically because of the terrible pressure of the United States, on a strong voice in the World Bank and in the International Monetary Fund, which is now forcing structural adjustment on Nicaragua.
Now, is this a new status, or has it always been second to Haiti and poorest?
No, this drop to, from subsistence to poverty to starvation has happened in 10 years. It is, according to the United Nations, it's the country that has dropped most rapidly in decency of living to growing poverty. It has dropped most rapidly in peacetime of any country in the history that since the United Nations has been keeping data. And that is specifically because the revolutionary government, as you'll recall, the Sandinistas made a revolution in and they came to power July 19, 1979. They made that revolution because they could no longer tolerate an increasingly cruel dictatorship, a dictatorship which was put in place and maintained by the United States government.
The Somoza regime.
The what the Sandinistas did for 10 years, they put the poorest of the poor as their first priority. That meant health care, schools, care of the elderly, care of the disabled, new housing so people didn't have to live on the streets, increased social services for mental health services. You did not find mentally ill people who needed care wandering on the streets, suffering, lonely, homeless. It just didn't exist in the revolutionary government. Now, why did the Sandinistas do this? Because they wanted sovereignty. They thought that Nicaragua could be its own boss and not be anymore a client state of the United States. Well, since, and of course the United States couldn't tolerate that. The Monroe Doctrine is alive and well in the Western Hemisphere. Since 1823, the Monroe Doctrine saying that anything that happens in this hemisphere is the business of the United States of America, and governments will exist only with the approval of the United States. Now, the Sandinistas said, no, we want to claim our dignity. We are going to run our own show. They ran a mixed economy. There were capitalist ventures. There were socialist ventures. There were state-owned institutions, always with the services to the poorest of the poor as being first priority. So they left the client being a nice client state of the United States. Now, since 1990, that has shifted. We now have in government a regime, Dr. Arnoldo Alemán, who fled with Somoza in, he probably fled the country before the insurrection, July 19, 1979, went to Miami with other Somocistas. He was head of Somoza Youth, akin to Hitler Youth. And he returned at the fall of the Sandinistas, became mayor and of Managua, and now he is president of the United States. I mean, president of Nicaragua.
Before you go on, of course, people who are listening, I'm sure, who are familiar with Nicaragua know that for years a U.S.-financed insurrection was victimizing Nicaragua. The Contra movement, some of whom may have illegitimate grievances, many of whom were simply funded out of drug money and foreign funding. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, about the Contra War. The Contra War was started by the CIA with a handful of ex-Somoza National Guard military who had fled into Honduras when the Sandinistas drove them out of the country, drove the Somoza National Guard out of the country. The United States funded, through the CIA, the beginning of the counter-revolution. So that's why they're called Contras, the Contra-Revolutionaries. Increasingly, the Contras grew with U.S. funding from Mr. Reagan, afterward from Mr. Bush, and the army of the Contra grew. These were campesinos, Nicaraguan campesinos, that were recruited often under threat of death and were sent to Honduras and received training by United States Army, and I believe Marines were involved, but I know United States Army were involved, CIA operatives, and they infiltrated Nicaragua to destroy the infrastructure of Nicaragua and depress the people, cause the people. Their goal was to cause the people to withdraw support of the revolutionary government.
Now, were they successful?
Actually, they were not successful. The Sandinistas beat them militarily. And the Sandinistas, who didn't want war, they were simply defending themselves against this war of aggression, continually made peace initiatives and finally brought, much to the consternation of the United States government, brought peace to Nicaragua, stopped the shooting war because of their initiatives. Because it was very painful for the revolutionary people to see Nicaraguans killing Nicaraguans.
And when did this peace happen?
The peace happened at the end of 1979. In 1990, the Sandinistas had an election. It was an extremely transparent election, a very fair election, with the exception that the United States government poured millions of dollars to get Violeta Chamorro elected, to defeat the Sandinista government. I knew of campesinos who were receiving $50 cash to vote for Doña Violeta Chamorro.
You were down there at this time.
Yes.
You went to Nicaragua in 1989?
Well, I first went 85, 86 with Witness for Peace, which, as you'll recall, Robert, was the effort of the U.S. peace community to interpose ourselves between the Nicaraguan people and the United States finance Contra. I stayed there for a year and went back in 89. So I was there in the country at the time of the elections. Now, since 1990, there were two reasons why the revolution, as I understand it, why the revolutionary government was voted out. One, the people were tired of war. I met families, mothers and fathers, who lost 4 and 5 children in the war, and they just said, we cannot do it anymore. We are weary. No more killing. No more blood. So that was one very important factor. The other important factor was the heavy financing of the United States government. And since then, as I mentioned earlier, Nicaragua has returned to a very comfortable, the government has a comfortable relationship with the International Monetary Fund, is now a good client of the capitalist system, well-behaved, but this has been at the great cost. The external debt is number one priority, to pay, to service the debt. This servicing of the external debt is to, at the cost of social services. The healthcare system is nearly collapsed. There is no more free education. Everything is being privatized. Most children do not go to school because parents cannot afford, with 70 to 85% unemployment, people simply do not have the cash money to pay the school fees that are now required. There is no free education in Nicaragua. There is no free health care. And this is all of this beautiful social services that the Sandinistas put in place are gone.
Now, what about people you know down there? Have you got a way of maybe giving us a kind of a picture of what's happened to a family you know between 1989 and 1998?
My friends, with my co-workers in Nicaragua, they were people who had a little bit of land. They are people who, instead of leaving Nicaragua, and instead of leaving, rather, Mulukuku, which even to this day continues to be very dangerous with armed bands roaming around, have stayed. They have struggled. My friends have struggled to organize the people. They are Sandinista militants. They believe still in the goals of the revolution. They, with solidarity, we can do nothing in Nicaragua without solidarity help, without the sharing of the resources in other parts of the world, especially in the United States, which is still one of the richest countries in the world. Even though we see so much suffering and increasing poverty here, there's still a significant amount of wealth in this country, as we know.
What were you doing in Nicaragua yourself during this period of time?
I was invited by a cooperative of women to help them organize health services. Women were having babies every year. They were dying for lack of prenatal care. They were dying from badly done abortions. And the women organized themselves into a co-op and were looking for someone and looking for a nurse to help them organize health services. So since 1990, I've been working with women in the mountains, in the northeastern part of the country, in the Atlantic Autonomous Region, North Atlantic Autonomous Region, I've been working with them, and we have developed a health clinic that serves women and children. We are working with the health brigadistas, the barefoot doctors that the Sandinistas developed, trained during the revolutionary years, and we're doing the best we can to meet the needs of more than 25,000 people who have been completely abandoned by their healthcare system, by their government.
How would you measure your own success in that situation, or have you been able to train other people? What's been happening in that region?
I work with 7 women from the community that have been trained to give primary health care, to manage soy nutrition projects, who do health teaching. These women are all in school. 2 of them are in they're health promoters, they're called. 2 of them are taking a high school course in 2 years. They will be going to nursing school, so we will have our own indigenous nurses from the village serving the people. So in terms of developing initiatives for people solving their own problems, yes, that is in progress. Another very important part of our work is the consciousness raising of women, helping women to understand the causes of their marginalization, helping women to understand what their rights are as human beings. People, it is a great surprise to women that they have the right to be in charge of their own bodies, that they can choose when and how many babies they will have. It is a great revelation to women to know that they don't have to be abused by their male partners, and that they can stand up and with other women defend themselves. And learn how to read and write, learn how to manage the legal system. So this is part of our work, and probably the most important part of our work is to help women learn the skills to organize themselves and to defend themselves in a collective manner and to find solutions to their problems.
While you've been gone and things have been deteriorating in Nicaragua, things have also been deteriorating in the U.S. In terms of the destruction of the welfare net and immiseration of poor people generally, and of course the enriching of the upper 1%. What do you see in Santa Cruz? Do you see a change from a decade ago?
I'm afraid I can't comment on that, Robert. I just arrived in Santa Cruz late yesterday.
Well, get busy here.
I will. I still appreciate the beauty of Santa Cruz. I think we're very blessed here to have this beautiful, clean air, sunshine, gorgeous ocean. And I think that because we're privileged here, that maybe that we have to give a little more than in other places to care for our sister and brother human beings.
Which may be an appropriate moment to ask, are you seeking any work for any help for any particular kind of project that's going on in Nicaragua that you want to make an appeal for.
Thank you, Robert. Yes. I and a co-worker, an organizer from Nicaragua, are doing a tour on the West Coast specifically for fundraising. We are totally dependent upon the partnership of our friends primarily in this country. And we are giving a talk Sunday at 2 p.m. There's a reception, and we'll make a presentation at 2 o'clock at the Loudon Nelson Center.
This Sunday or next Sunday?
This Sunday, April 19th. And also on Friday, April 17th at 7:30 p.m. at the Loudon Nelson Center, I am being honored by an international peace prize for the work in Nicaragua. And I'll be talking there a bit about what are the some of the initiatives and nonviolent tactics that have been used in that area to help the people. So, but the general meeting to find out about our work and a fundraising reception is 2 p.m., 2 to 5, Sunday, April 19th at the Loudon Nelson Center.
That's next week. But today, however, is actually nothing's happening specifically today except what you're hearing. And you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz at 96.3 FM. And we're listening to Dorothy Granada, who has just gotten back from Nicaragua, where she has been working, as you've heard, to do the kinds of things that actually make a difference in real people's lives. If you want to talk to her, she's here in the studio, and our phone lines are open at 423-5361. I'm going to, of course, in my own rather narrow way, attempt to focus on poverty issues here in Santa Cruz as well, because, we can't really, I guess we can inform people about what's happening in Nicaragua, and I'm glad we can, but there's much broader support, ironically, for helping Nicaraguans here in Santa Cruz, and I think there is for helping people in Santa Cruz, which is my primary concern here. You may remember when you were here before, people you knew were going to jail for sleeping outside and peacefully trying to bring this issue to a city council that's supposedly progressive.
Yeah. Well, I was arrested twice. I slept all night on the street, had some at the town clock. I have always been concerned about the homeless. But Robert, it's all one problem. The forces that are forcing people on the street, the cruelty that is dominant in Santa Cruz in the mentality of people is the same cruelty that is killing people in Nicaragua. We can't look anymore at the issue separate. We have to be concerned at home, and we have to show our solidarity with people in other parts of the world. And I really like to make those connections, that they're not separate issues, they're all one issue. But I always, as I mentioned earlier, appeal to people to see who is suffering outside your door. Who are the people of color? It's an issue with me. I am a Chicana. I know racism and classism in my bones from having come out of East L.A. And I know how the people in this country, I'm sensitive to how the people in this country are suffering. It's the same suffering. It's the same evil that is causing the suffering here that is causing the suffering in L.A., in Nicaragua, in Africa, in Asia. And we have to make the connections. We have to work locally, but think globally as well.
Along the lines of working locally, let me put you on the spot here and ask you, it's probably not putting you on the spot, I take it you opposed the sleeping ban back in 1988, and you probably still oppose it now.
It is a fundamental human right for everyone born on this planet to have a roof over her head. I also believe it is a fundamental right to have health care and to have education, but the very first right, and to have food, the very first right is to have a shelter. To me, there is nothing more cruel than in the elements, in the cold, to see people sleeping outside. It is the first and most fundamental element, right to be born on this planet. We must be able to have a roof over our heads.
Actually, what progressives on the city council have said, yes, you know, we certainly want to see affordable housing, decent housing, low-income housing for folks here in Santa Cruz. But to make it legal for people to sleep in their vehicles and cars, this is no solution to homelessness. Therefore, let's keep in place a law that makes it illegal for people to sleep and prescribes a $162 fine and 6 months in jail, and a $1,000 fine for the second offense. Unfortunately, that's the position of our current city council. They are all for shelter, they say, but in fact, there will be less than 40 people sheltered on the floors of churches come, I guess, May 1st, out of 500 to 1,500 homeless people in Santa Cruz. What's your reaction to that?
Well, my reaction is that people who make decisions for the ideal, they say they want the ideal, and yet negate practical steps, are avoiding the issue. And I think that they have to be confronted and made help to be see the error of their ways. And, you know, certainly we want people all to have a decent roof, warm, comfortable bed, safety, which you don't have in an automobile. But if the automobile is the first recourse, then by all means people must be allowed to at least get out of the weather, because people simply cannot disappear at sundown. They simply can't. So until a community can provide what we consider to be minimum decent housing, any kind of shelter is better than nothing. I mean, it seems quite obvious to me.
You may be interested to know that the bridges, under the bridge,